Hi, I'm Koen from the Netherlands.
I'm Angel from China.
And from a rainy Mostar.
Welcome to our podcast.
Today our guest will be Noelle. Noelle, can you tell us a bit about yourself, introduce yourself?
Yes. So my name is Noelle Faiza. I am Tunisian American. My father is Tunisia and I've spent a lot of my childhood in Tunisia with, so it is a part of my nationality. I do think, though, that because of my background, I might be a little biased with some of these answers, but I also feel that my opinion is shared by the majority of Tunisians.
So talking about the story, can you tell us about what's been going on in Tunisia in the past few weeks? Just the general outline.
So this summer, Tunisia faced one of the worst crises since, I would say, the revolution. With the COVID pandemic, honestly, Tunisia was doing pretty good up until that point. The Minister of Health was being quite celebrated, but then due to tourism, the country had to open up. Because tourism is the largest industry in Tunisia. The beaches are world famous. It's a really big point for people to come vacation in the summer. And it got out of control. COVID crisis was it was horrible. People were dying in the streets. It was very, very dire part of the pandemic. It was probably the worst since the beginning. And the whole health system of Tunisia collapsed. It was officially technically collapsed. And there was a lot of perseverance in that. And now the situation has been improving, and I'll come to that soon. But because of that crisis, the government needed to respond. And quite frankly, the parliament was not. They were focused on things that were just not relevant to the people. They had a massive disconnect from people. Most of the people in parliament, or the majority coalition, is with two parties. Ennahda, which is the Islamic party, the Islamist party, and Qalb Tunis, which means heart Tunis, the heart of Tunis. And both of those parties are in the ultra-rich community. They have mansions throughout the world. They have properties in the nicest areas of Tunisia. And they're also known for a lot of corruption, which is very problematic, obviously. And because corruption was a really big reason for the Jasmine Revolution against the dictator in 2011, I believe. So they were focused on things like getting money for politicians that had been under fire before, very disconnected from the people. It was very frustrating. And because of that gridlock, the president, Kais Saied, decided to invoke Article 80 of the Constitution, which gives him the power to freeze parliament and kind of take over the government, but only in a crisis. And in this article, it says that he should have the consent of the prime minister, the head of parliament, etc. But because the prime minister was also part of the problem, he didn't. So that's where the word coup comes in, and Western media has been using the word coup a lot because they feel that he did not have the legal right, but there was legal precedence, and it is what the majority of the people of Tunisia wanted. And when that happened, the leader of the Qalb Tunis party fled to Algeria, where he's now imprisoned for illegally entering Algeria, and also it's a popular decision to imprison him because he is known for his corruption. Both in the Islamist party and Qalb Tunis are known for bribing people to vote because the unemployment rate in Tunisia is really high, poverty is very high, especially with the crisis. They were literally bribing through food. They would send people tomato paste and couscous and say, you see what we do for you? This is why we should have your vote. Simple as that. So, and also financially bribing important people, etc. So that was more reasons for Kais to freeze parliament. And so when that happened, Western media framed it as a coup, etc. But he did have the precedence of Article 80. And the majority of Tunisians and the atmosphere in Tunisia really strongly agrees with that decision because of how disconnected the government was from the people. And so since then, that happened in late July, I believe. And Kais started a vaccine rollout program. So he was able to respond unilaterally to the COVID crisis. And with that, now the population of Tunisia went from barely any vaccinations to 33% of the population being vaccinated, which if you compare it, like, let's say to my other nationality, the US, we have 56% of the population vaccinated. And we've had the vaccine since January, February. Like, we were one of the first countries to get it. So it's actually really impressive what he's been able to do. And the COVID crisis, it's like night and day in just a couple months because he's taken over. And recently he has installed the new prime minister to form the new parliament. So there is hope. She is a really respected scholar. I believe her name is Najla Ramdoun.
The first female prime minister in Tunisia, right?
Yes, in all of the Arab world. So actually very impressive woman. She's a really important liaison to many international institutions, I believe such as the World Food Bank, institutions like that. So she has a really experienced world view on politics and is coming in as prime minister promising to make 50% of the parliament women, which is really impressive and is a really amazing step for Tunisia. And I think Kais made a really great choice. A big part of why the population supports Kais so much is because before he was president, he was just a law professor, and he's never really had ties to big money. And he kind of really makes the ethical point of that. The history of Tunisia too, like Habib Bourguiba, the first president, he famously invested in schools rather than the military, because he said our best weapon is knowledge. And like, that's a really big part of Tunisian culture, I would say. Maybe that's also part of my bias. I come from a family of educators, but that's also part of why, like, that spirit of education first. And Tunisia was also the home of the first university. I don't know if it's period, that might be just a little bit of nationalism, but it was like the first university, maybe in North Africa, something like that, like University of Kairouan. So there is this culture of like really supporting scholars. And in my opinion, I think that's a really great thing for government. And so far, scholars have been really effective in responding to the pandemic crisis. And I think Kais installing a female scholar instead of an Islamist prime minister is really important. Also, I feel like when I'm talking about the Islamist party, it's kind of important for me to mention the overall, I almost would say proxy war, actually, of Islamist parties in Western North Africa. So there's two main blocks in the Arab world that holds a lot of power. Qatar and Turkey, even though Turkey isn't an Arab country, but they still are a heavy power. So Qatar and Turkey, and then on the other hand, Saudi and the UAE. And pretty much all Islamist parties can be argued are descendant of the Muslim Brotherhood, even if they like really make a point to not affiliate, things like that. The Muslim Brotherhood from like the early 20th century,
yeah,
it's like the first Islamist party. And they've always, to a certain extent, had the backing of Qatar and Turkey. And the UAE and Saudi is against Islamist parties, which might seem a little counterintuitive, like given Saudi runs, like they claim they run on Sharia law, but it's because of, also Egypt is there with Saudi and the UAE. So that's kind of the dynamic that's there. And one critical piece of this puzzle in understanding the Islamist party and why I call it a proxy war too, is Qatar controls Al Jazeera because they are a really heavy funder of Al Jazeera. And Qatar also funds things like the Islamist party in Tunisia and Islamist parties everywhere. Meanwhile, Saudi and the UAE fund the parties that are against Islamist parties. So they're kind of using Tunisia as a playing field to try to control their agenda, because if they put Islamist power in Tunisia, they secure an ally in the Arab world. And so with that in mind, Qatar has been funding Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera is where a lot of Western media gets their, like, they call, like, kind of a credible source in, like, their take. And Al Jazeera was one of the first sources to call it a coup and, like, use that language. And they presented it in very biased ways, hardly any mention, like, Article 80 of the Constitution, like, the actual situation. There's very little of, like, listening to Tunisians' voice in this dialogue. And because of that, politicians in the U.S., like, I was talking about, like, my dual nationality here, have gone so far, like, Ilhan Omar, a congressman, said that we should, the U.S. should sanction Tunisia until the undemocratic, like to preserve democracy, like all this was like on Twitter and whatever, and she got a lot of backlash for that from Tunisians, and especially Tunisians Americans in diaspora, as there are a lot of us, saying what the hell, basically, no, like, you listen to Tunisians' voices in this, because it is kind of these two blocks in the Middle East that are running this conversation, and there isn't a lot of Tunisian voice providing to these sources. And like, for example, like, there's a really big petition going around among diaspora Tunisians in the U.S. saying, like, we do not want another U.S. action meddling in our politics. Like, let Tunisia sort this out. We're doing a pretty good job. And so, yeah, that's
so,
kind of the situation.
So, basically, the scenario right now is the Western countries, like, with the low-key biases, like, they think, yeah, the regime right now is undemocratic, they're not listening to people's voices. Meanwhile, like, the actual Tunisian people, they think, yeah, like, what the president is doing right now is what it wants.
Yeah.
But right now, are there any, like, because I saw a lot of, like, headlines of the newspaper, they mentioned, like, protest, instability, but is there any, like, a protest right now, like, or it's just, like, small amount of people?
I mean, when Qais Saied froze the parliament, he did it on I'm trying to think of the it's the holiday commemorating Habib Bourguiba's, like, declaration. It's called, okay, Declaration of the Republic, that's the translation. So in that day, Habib Bourguiba, like, the founder of Tunisia, or the first president of Tunisia, like, officially said, like, we are separating from France, like, founding our own republic. And so he, like, took back Tunisia, basically, on that day. And then Qais Saied symbolically also froze parliament on the same day to, like, take back Tunisia that from the parliament and from corruption. So I think it's, I could be so wrong, but I think it's July 27th. I think that's the date. Or July 21st. And so when he did that, there were a lot of protests already, because that is, like, the day of protests, the day of, like, taking Tunisia back in a way, and also it's all, it can be a day of celebration, but it's also, in that case, it was a day of protest because the people were in such crisis. And so there were a lot of protests supporting him. There were also counter-protesters that support the Islamist Party, but I think the population that supports the Islamic Party is a, it's, the thing is, it's a hefty minority of, like, 20%, about.
Okay.
But because it's, like, I would say it's the largest party in Tunisia, because there's so many, it's, like, it's a really good coalition system. So there's so many other parties that have, like, 1 to 5 or 10% of the population.
Okay.
So they're, like, the party, them and Club Tunis, which is the other corrupt party, I think they have about 16% of the population. They're, like, the two corrupt parties, and together they form a majority in parliament. And, like, going to the point real quick of, like, Western powers again saying it was undemocratic, because a lot of the argument there is, like, them just outsiders looking in, they're like, the parliament was elected by the people, or, you know, like, they're the representatives of the people, so Qais Saied wiping them, like, freezing the parliament is not listening to the voices of the people. But Tunisians know that the people were bribed and manipulated to voting these people in the parliament. And they also, when the Islamist Party was trying to get elected, they promised, like, they swore that they would not work with the leader of the Qaid party, because he's known to be an absolute, bad person.
big corruption
like,
there.
Very, like, he's a billionaire, big business mogul, big media mogul. He's kind of the Donald Trump of Tunisia, if you will. Like, he's known, they would not do work with him.
Okay.
And then the first thing they did when they got in parliament is they made a coalition with him and his party. And so many Tunisians were also protesting that. They felt betrayed. So a lot of people that also voted for the Islamist party regret that decision. I know a lot of people that did vote for the Islamist party because they just felt like it was the safest option. Because there's that relatability, like, they share my religion, I trust their judgment, you know. And they regret it so much. Like, there's a lot of waning support. Like, I honestly doubt it's still 20% of the population. Because Club Tunis and the Islamist Party, I don't think they can come back from this, honestly. And they've taken a really big blow from the president, which, in my opinion, is a really good thing, and we should keep government secular. Mm-hmm. And I think the majority of Tunisians also feel that way.
No, actually, I wonder, so I know the Muslim Brotherhood, the party of Morsi actually is also considered as an Islamist party, but they are not like seeking for like the ruling the country with like Quran with the Islamist law. It's more like secular Islamic party. So when you're talking about like in Tunisia, is it like the party similar to the what you're thinking in Egypt or?
I mean, to be honest, I think that it's not like they want to enact like Sharia law. Like, it's not
okay. It's
not like the party wants to do that. But I also really don't think they're secular. Like, they do claim like everything they do, everything that drives them is like Islam. So kind of whatever that interpretation is, I feel like that's all I can really like speak to it. Like, honestly, because I just have like such a bad opinion of them. I don't know how, like, I just don't think like Islamists belong in government, and Tunisia has never been like a very like ever since the 12th century, Tunisia has been a pretty like the way Tunisians hold Islam, and also in like most of like what's called the Maghrib, like Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, is influenced by like scholars like Ibn Khaldun and these Islamist scholars who are like really famous in the Arab world, who preached Islam to be a personal thing. Like, they were kind of for criticizing religion and criticizing like the Quran, and that's the way you prove that you are like a true believer, because if you were just to accept it blindly, you're not really having any love for it. Like, if you have a child and you never punish them, or you never question them, or you never like you know like try to raise them right, like, that's, and it's also, there's way less organized religion. Like, there are mosques, of course, but it's really common to find a lot of people that don't go to mosques, especially in my generation and like my parents' generation. So it's kind of moving in the direction of like secularism. Like, they're, I would say, like, the international community is also moving in. So the Islamist party really feels like it has no place. And I think that's also where the influence of countries like Qatar is so obvious. Because if it wasn't for them, I don't think the Islamist party would really have any hold. Because where would they get their money? Like, their influence, their ability to, like, have propaganda and sway the Tunisian people that are not, like, usually inclined to go towards religion mixing with politics.
Okay, now so the traditional way of ruling, like the Islamic way of ruling, is gradually fading, right?
Yeah, and it's never really been the traditional way in Tunisia.
That's good.
Yeah.
Did you talk to a family back in Tunisia about this? Like, how do they feel about these developments?
I talk to my family in Tunisia pretty often about these things, especially over the summer when the crisis.
So it's not a topic you avoid.
No, we debate a lot about it. One of my uncles actually used to support the Islamist party just because he was like, even though he carries religion like in his own way, like, you wouldn't look at him and be like, oh, he looks like, he strikes me as a religious guy. He just felt, okay, I don't trust the government very much because since the revolution, etc., there's not a lot of faith in the government, but I do trust my religion. And that was kind of, like, the logic. Like, so I'm going to trust people of my religion. And, like, they seem like good people. Like, they care about lifting people out of poverty. Because Islam does have, like, those main, like, ideally has those main tenets, you know, of like charity, of ending poverty, of human rights, of equality. Like a lot of Muslims argue Muhammad was the first feminist, you know, like there are these qualities. And like the argument of Muhammad is first feminist comes from him giving rights to women, like inheritance, right to like leave husbands, that in Europe at the same time, like 500 AD-ish, there were no rights at all for like those for women in that way. So the idea is like he put Islam on like a path to, like almost like politically made a first move to put Islam on a path and continually make getting closer to feminism, like to the equality of the sexes. And that's kind of the interpretation most Tunisians have, which is also different from a lot of like the governments in the Arab world. I don't want to make that generalization, but like if you look at Saudi, for example, like that contrast. So yeah, I think that gives a little bit more context on like the nature of Islam and like the life of like the average Tunisian. But when I do have these like debates in my family, this is the kind of thing that comes up, and a lot of them say honestly, like, yeah, that was stupid of me. I should have just trusted like the democratic process, whatever, and voted for another candidate, another party, because the Islamists literally lied. Like they went back on their word, which is not something like that is an Islamic principle at all, you know? So it's like there's no faith in that party at all anymore, I would say, in most people. But honestly, the most difficult thing when I was talking to my family this summer with everything was the crisis, the COVID crisis. Like so many of my family members got COVID. I have family members that work in the hospital. Like my closest cousin, she's doing her residency right now as a doctor, and she's like, gosh, like 23, and she's like honestly one of my best friends, and the things that she has seen is crazy, because there's also a massive oxygen shortage, so the resources were just not there, and the government at the time was not focusing on getting them, so there was so much frustration, so much anguish, fear. It was just really tragic. And the night when Qais lifted the parliament, Tunisians worldwide shared the experience of like being up all night, like talking about this, stressing, watching the news. My house, we were all in the living room, like on the edge of our seat, like all of us reading articles, talking about it. Like the TV was on, like flipping through stations, going on Facebook, calling family, because there were a lot of protests in celebration, almost like in support and counter protests. And it was just a really emotional time, very confusing time, because also like just hearing about it, seeing like me as a like Tunisian American, I'll probably look at like my phone will pop up in English news first, like that's what's going to be easiest for me to find. And then I was like so confused reading about a coup, and then like I go to like a Tunisian site, and then I'm like, oh gosh, what? It just so many confusing narratives that like took a minute to, in that panic almost, to try to piece it together. So there was so much conversation, there was so much discussion, and it was honestly a really emotional summer, I think, for the average Tunisian, because the country was in crisis on the pandemic health level and on the political level.
Okay, so as you said, there's protests like actually supporting someone, and there's like also protests like against someone. So I feel like since the Jasmine Revolution, protests is one of the most important like form for Tunisian to like speak their voice. So is that true that like every time, like do you guys protest a lot?
Yeah, I mean I would say so, because under Ben Ali, so the dictator before the revolution, protesting was very difficult. Like I remember walking through the city with my dad and seeing banners of the dictator's face like on the street, and like almost like a celebration, like they were always up, and I was so confused, and I was like, Baba, like he's so ugly, like what is this? And my dad was like, don't talk about it right now. And I remember I was so confused, and I went home and I was like, what the heck, why can't we talk about it? Because also I'm coming, like I I'm also, like, coming from the States where I can make fun of any politician I want, you know? And that was, like, that kind of dynamic between my two identities, and then seeing that, I would definitely say that the revolution, it didn't necessarily kickstart, like, the, like, a culture of protest, but it would return to a culture of protest, because also Habib Bourguiba was an amazing revolutionary against the French, and, like, our rebellion against the French is honestly, in my opinion, like, it's the legacy of colonization still permeates our culture, like, in so many different ways, and we still need to, like, rebel in that way too. So we're used to resisting, I guess, and, like, resisting an oppressor, whether from the inside or the outside, resisting corruption, whether in, like, from foreign powers or from the inside. And we do, I think, now protest a lot because we fought for that right again. We fought against the dictator, and we now can. And we really do, like, try to use our voice in every single way. And even when the dictator was around, there were so many, like, scuffles, I guess. They're kind of kept under wraps, especially between students and the police, especially in journalism. Like, I hear stories from my dad when he was in college. He was, you know, throwing back the, like, little grenades that, like, cops will throw at protesters, back at the cops, you know, being scared of things like when he was speaking in newspapers or doing interviews, like, his neighbors that are getting paid by the police to kind of, you know, be snitches, like, listen on in on revolutionary talk, like, being scared of the secret police coming at any point to just come take him as a student, and, like, him and all his friends had that experience. There's always kind of been a resistance, and I also hear, like, grow up hearing my grandfather's stories of resistance against the French, against the Nazis too, during World War II. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, sorry it was a little long-winded, there is definitely a culture of protests in Tunisia, and I don't think it was started by the revolution. I think we just were able to kind of be more loud again.
There's something embedded in the history, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Passed down, I think, almost. Like an inheritance.
Okay. So, wait, what would I ask? Okay, so it has been 10 years since the revolution. And I feel like compared to the neighboring countries like Egypt, which is repeating in the democratic elected government, and then another authoritarian General Sisi, and then also the neighbor country like Libya, who's still in the war. So I feel like Tunisia is actually doing relatively well in terms of, like, the political stability. So what do you think, like, what did Tunisia do to make the difference, to make the countries, like, going in a different direction from its neighboring countries?
I mean, I think it kind of dates back to the revolution itself. Like, Tunisia was the first country in the Arab Spring to have a revolution. It's kickstarted the Arab Spring, like, as a whole. And I think that was kind of a benefit because the Ben Ali, like, I mean, I bet he kind of saw it coming, like, the rising resistance, but he also didn't have, like, a clear heads up, you know, like the other countries that came after. When there started to be talk on things like Facebook about revolution, they kind of saw what was possible, and they took a more authoritative, militaristic, like, response. Meanwhile, Ben Ali pretty much just got out of, like, he just left Tunisia. He didn't wait for it to go to, like, civil war,
okay,
you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of, I don't know if I want to call it lucky, but I think it's an important factor to kind of think of. Like, there wasn't a lot of destruction left from the revolution. There wasn't a lot of, like, carnage, things to pick back up.
Okay.
It was kind of just, okay, he's gone. We need to build a new government, and that's where things like the Truth and Dignity Committee come in, like, that part of the Tunisian government that is sole purpose to weed out corruption, prevent corruption from happening again. So we were able to rebuild, and I also think, like, our culture of like scholarship, I almost want to say. I feel kind of biased, but I don't want to say it's like our culture of scholarship, but it also, in my opinion, is, but whatever. Led to a lot of educated people being part of the rebuilding. It wasn't necessarily a time for a political power grab. Like how in Egypt afterwards, it was kind of like Islamists came to power almost right after, and then Sisi had a coup. Like that's, it was really like power vacuums. But in Tunisia, it was a scholarly rebuild of the government.
It's like a smooth, relatively smooth power transition.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a lot of popular efforts around it. It was a really united front. Like, I don't think there were a lot of loyalists, but I also may not think that because I've never really been surrounded by any. But it's mostly just, like, the very upper class that was benefiting from Ben Ali. Like, people like my family, a 500-person village, people like living in Sidi Bou Zaid, where the revolution started, they were being oppressed in poverty and being kept in poverty by the dictator. So it was really a united front in wanting to build back better and wanting to make it build a government that would not allow for dictators. Because there'd only been two presidents of Tunisia up to that point. There'd been Habib Bourguiba and then Ben Ali. And Ben Ali was like the second in command to Bourguiba. So Bourguiba, you know, we still kind of, we love him a lot as a country. But in his older age, he did kind of start to become senile on his grasp on power. And we needed to build a system that wouldn't let that happen, no matter how endearing the politician was to all of us.
So looking forward, do you have any expectations or any hopes for what happens now with, you know, of course, the new parliament being instated?
Yeah, I really hope the new prime minister does a good job. I'm also just really hopeful. I'm really hopeful for Tunisia in general. Like, we're really building some amazing, like, environmental policies, for example. Like, my municipality just installed this whole policy on protecting turtles, which I love, because also part of the crisis this summer was an over-infestation of jellyfish that were on the beaches and killing the tourism industry along with COVID. So we're really coming up with more innovative solutions to these problems instead of like reactive. I mean, they are still reactive, but in a productive way, I guess. So they're also preventative for going forward. And I'm really proud, I guess, to say that Kais Saied chose a female prime minister who's also an intellectual, not coming from a rich family, not getting there because of connections, and who's going to hopefully continue to set a precedent. I really think that this set a precedent of Islamist parties are not going to... Islamist parties, and honestly, it's less about Islam and more about the corruption that bringing religion into government, in my opinion, holds, and also with Club Tunis, like, they're just straight-up corruption. I'm really hoping that will be alleviated, and the parliament is going to... I think, hopefully, the people learned from this, like, is just all of us can just learn once and for all about what kind of parties we should be voting into power. And I'm really hoping that somehow we can bring more international awareness to what is actually happening with the two Middle Eastern power blocks. And I really hope Qatar and Turkey get out of our politics and let Tunisia, and also I hope the US gets out of our politics, and I hope Tunisia is able to be for Tunisians, built by Tunisians, because when that happens is when we tend to prosper.
I think we can finish it off on that note, and I'd like to thank you for telling your story, and I'd like to thank the listeners for listening to the episode. Next
thank
week
you.
We'll be
yeah.
back